This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, or one of our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners all the way across the country, now internationally as well, and our podcast audience, of course, all of our listeners here. It is Christmas Day live here on the show, if you're listening live through CIUT or possibly through a streamer. If not, this is our Christmas Day show. So I'm a bit tired, but I'm awake. I'm here. And you know who else is awake in here and seems much more awake than me is both Kevin Farmer and M.A. Ma, which is great. Thank you both for coming in. I know Kevin's got his hands free right now, but thank you for joining me, M.A., who's available.
Yeah, great to be here. You might have to qualify what awake actually means, though.
I did very
have
good.
A good, strong cup of coffee.
Well, I've got, regardless of your awakeness, I do still have, whether ours or yours, the listener, we do have a very sort of relaxed show. I have a trend now, as many people know, because I don't go very long without mentioning it. We've been on the air since 2006. Since I've been involved with sort of running the show, we've had a semi-tradition that's really started to solidify in the last sort of 3 years here, of really taking a very relaxed attitude towards our approximately Christmas Day and approximately New Year's Day show. This year, they actually do fall literally on Christmas Day and New Year's Day. But because of that, I don't get too worked up about trying to, you know, book guests is impossible and, you know, there's so much going on. So I always take this as an opportunity to have a little bit of fun. So last year what I did was I was actually here pretty much alone. I think Kevin might have been teching for me, or possibly not actually. But I just played a bunch of clips from a bunch of revolutionary movies because I was in a bit of a revolutionary mood. But this year I'm in a very thoughtful, pondering mood. So what we're going to do is I've pulled up here, and with the assistance of Kevin and M.A., a number of top 10 lists to look at. And these are not necessarily environment top 10 lists. In fact, zero of them are explicitly environment top 10 lists. I've got things here like the top 10 news stories, top 10 Internet of Things stories, top 10 entertainment stories, top 10 IT security stories, top 10 science news stories. And what we're just going to be doing is kind of, I'm not really even going to go through them necessarily or talk too much about the stories that are on them, but we're just going to sort of talk about what happened this year in general and sort of what happened this year might could lead to next year. So what sort of things should we be keeping an eye on? What sort of trends can we assess from the year of 2015? I am someone who's a very big fan of round numbers. I think it has a little bit to do with being a bit obsessive compulsive. But I love this idea, 2015. It sounds great. I'm as excited about the close of this year as I was about hitting the 2000s personally. So it seems important, and so I think a moment of reflection is due. What I'm going to do here, maybe we can start with this one, because, M.A., you said that it had occurred to you, you've been thinking about it recently as well. So one of the ones here was one of the most fun is the Scientific American top 10 science stories. And, of course, one of the stories, which is their number 10 here, but I hadn't even thought of, because it seems like so much has happened, was the Ebola outbreak. I forgot that that was this year. But one of the things I wanted to pull from that, and then I'll throw to M.A. To you for comments as well. But, you know, Ebola being not specific, so just the idea of sort of global disease, and we had SARS a few years ago and a few other things, and that one of the things, you know, people will say, well, you know, we have all these advances in technology, but these advances in technology and health sciences specifically, you know, it seems like we can never win. Will there ever be an end to disease? And one of the things there that I like to identify as a factor was that one of the things is that, you know, if we're thinking about, and it comes down to a worldview thing, I guess is what I'm trying to say, I mean, because when we think of ourselves as sort of the master of this planet, we think of, you know, diseases as these pesky things that, you know, nip at our heels and once in a while they take us down. But generally speaking, we are mighty and they are, you know, bugs. But You know, I think if you look at it from sort of a from an ecosystem point of view or from a health sciences point of view, we are just food for them, and size is irrelevant. And with things like overpopulation and crowding and poor sanitation, we're essentially creating buffets for bugs and viruses and bacteria. And that's why, so when we have sort of these increasingly impoverished amount of people living in increasingly dense sort of urban centers, we're essentially creating a perfect storm for these types of things. And it's probably only going to increase. And I guess what I find confusing is why people seem confused when we have these, like, oh, why is it? Why does it seem so bad? And is it the fault of air travel, maybe? And to a certain degree, it is, because people can move around, you know, in very complicated things. But it's just kind of the world we live in, and it's going to get worse. And I think we should think about that. I've talked long enough.
So when I was thinking about Ebola, actually, I was thinking about it from a slightly different lens, though you've touched on it a little bit, Darren. The thing that springs into my mind is inequality. And if you look at what Ebola illuminated as a global health crisis this year, is one, under-resourced health systems in low-income countries, right? The fact that it could tear through communities in these countries in a way that took a lot of lives, devastated families, and that countries did not have a lot of immediate recourse. They really needed to reach out for international help. But you also need to look at who got treated first. And, you know, these are complex public policy decisions in terms of who gets a vaccine, for example, and when, and is it rolled out as a national program, and what are the resourcing implications. But fundamentally, I can't help but rest my mind on the fact that the people who were who contracted Ebola, who got the treatment that was life-saving, first and foremost, were largely Western people, right? Mm-hmm. There weren't people in the community in Sierra Leone, for example. And it just goes to show that we live in a world where some lives, sad to say it, seem to matter more than others. And like I said, I'm not trying to oversimplify what happened, but we really do need to rest our minds on that. And we need to always be looking at how we close that gap. Why is it the case that when you have a potential treatment to be rolled out, that resources really play into who gets it and who doesn't at the end of the day? And so Ebola treatment is being rolled out, but what we need to look at is what are the inequalities that it reveals in this whole journey that we've gone through with Ebola.
And I think that the theme there that I'm trying to draw, and that I'm going to draw through sort of basically the entire rest of the show, which was, if we look at this problem, and this is just one example, but if we look at this problem as a problem of, here's a bunch of countries and it's complicated because, you know, our relationships are complicated and maybe not everybody's friends and, you know, this and that, and should we help and blah, 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 and a bunch of sort of competing interests, and it gets very complicated. As you said, it gets very complicated. And I will submit this as piece of evidence number one, among many, and we'll go to Kevin, maybe he can arbitrate if he thinks this is a fair submission of evidence, that, you know, we already have climate change on the list. This is piece of evidence number two, let's call it, of a type of problem that threatens us all, because, you know, that what was the immediate news story in the U.S. was, oh, no, there might be a doctor who might have come back to the U.S. with Ebola. That was all the news coverage. Whereas maybe if we start thinking about this problem as we are now of a species that has, you know, de facto control of the planet to the extent that we understand control of things, and we have global impacts, and things we do are now going to affect globally. So we don't get to pretend like we have small little footprints anymore. We're going to be forced to work as a team if we're going to solve these problems. And Kevin's comment, I think, will be, well, we don't necessarily have any – we're not necessarily going to solve the problems. But just the idea – so I submit it to you, Kevin, that this is a piece of evidence number two, at least on this show today, that things like global health outbreaks and stuff like that are going to contribute to a changing world or are going to need to save us. That we need to start operating like a single planet because the impacts that we're causing that affect us, that are putting us in danger, are acting as an entire planet.
Well, hi, everyone. I just got to check my mic.
You sound good, buddy.
Oh, good, good. I just got to check the levels. The connection between the environment and Ebola, at least the outbreak in West Africa, might be a little more immediate than all of that. It's been hypothesized, even by the French environment minister, that deforestation destroyed the habitat of fruit bats, and they're known to carry Ebola. And by destroying their habitat, they were highly motivated or driven, really, to encroach on human settlements, human presence. And that might very well have been what sparked the outbreak. And whether it did or it didn't, it's still an object lesson in the fact that really nature is full of survival strategies that worked, and we have yet to demonstrate that our approach, the industrial civilization, is a survival strategy that's going to work. And the thing you can say about nature, you can say a lot of things about nature, but it exists in balance, and we are fundamentally upsetting that balance. And things like deforestation, linking ecosystems that never used to be linked before, driving roads through pristine forests, things like that. Like, all of these things, they add up. They certainly do. And your comment about, you know, the size of our footprint, we're huge. We're just huge. Like, individually, it just doesn't seem like much. But you've got to multiply what you do by 7 billion. Or take if you want to do a little bit of math, decide for yourself what a sustainable footprint is, and then for humanity, and then divide that by 7 billion. And then revise that quickly, because it's going to be 9 billion by 2050, and then 11 billion by the end of the century. So whatever our sustainable footprint now is, we're going to be revising it down for, you know, the rest of the century. And just to put that into perspective, how long ago did we introduce plastic microbeads into personal care and products? And we already had to ban them, because the lakes are filling up with them. I mean, anyone could have told you this was a stupid idea. Plastic microbeads that just go down the drain and into the nearest aquatic ecosystem. And the other one that just blows my mind is these little single use coffee things. Those little cups, those little plastic cups. They're like little Tetra Paks or something.
There's at least a dozen people listening right now that are drinking that.
Yeah, yeah, we'll stop.
Yeah,
I'm not saying don't insult it. I'm just saying.
No, but I despise
those things, I have to say.
But how long have we even been making them, and already we've produced enough of them that if we could even put those little things end-to-end, they'd circle the globe a few times. And that's just one little consumer product for one item. Admittedly, it's coffee. And plastic microbeads. Like, seriously, in the brief amount of time those things have existed, they're already a sizable impact on the world. And yeah, just individually, it might not seem like much, but there's a lot of us, and we are essentially indistinguishable from the effects of, you know, an asteroid strike or a supervolcano.
So I think it's important in terms of what you're saying, Kevin, we need to zoom out, right? It's the zoom out and look at, you know, that we're unable as a species, or an unwilling in some cases, to understand the consequences of human activity as it's being carried forward. However, we also need to zoom in and say it's not just about rebalancing of nature in terms of who's paying the price, right? And this is the thing that troubled me most. And I think, you know, we want to move forward, because there's a lot of other things to talk about with Ebola, though. Like, I lived and worked in Sierra Leone for a number of years, and the loss of life of those individuals who will never, you know, see through their potential in the future, it's unfair, it's disproportionate, and a lot of the activity ultimately that is destructive, it's not coming from the people of Sierra Leone or West Africa, it's coming from countries like Canada and the US and others. So I think as we zoom, we need to zoom out, and then we need to zoom back in. And I'm not saying that either of you were speaking contrary to that, but I think when we look at us as a species that's ravaging the planet, then we need to zoom back in and say, well, who's bearing the responsibility?
Oh, absolutely. And with China, cities in China lining up to issue red alerts for smog, which is the smog in China and India and places in India right now, is actually fatal. People can't live under that. And where is that smog coming from? It's factories that are producing goods that we're buying. Mm. You know, we've exported our pollution. It's wonderful to hear, and by wonderful, I mean aggravating as hell to hear people going on and on about our the size of our carbon footprint being like, you know, only 2%. So, you know, we don't need to do anything about that. And China should do something about that. I mean, well, yeah, right. Who are they producing for?
Close all borders and stop all trade, and then do that measurement again, and let's find out how big their footprint is.
Exactly. And the thing is, it's also just so smug of people to suddenly we're a line on a map. We're not individuals. We're a line on a map, and it's Canada only produces 2% of global greenhouse gas emissions. But individually, we're always listed as the first or the top one or two per capita consumers of energy on Earth. And so what you're really saying is, well, just because of where I popped out of my mommy's womb, I'm entitled to a much larger footprint than all of you people in China, where now, you know, if you zoom in and you look at that as an act of individual responsibility, that just does not pass the smell test under any circumstances.
So speaking of manufacturer products now, I'll move on to two other things. We're keeping the same theme. I'm just throwing some new meat into the pile to be chewed upon. Was another big
thing.
I'm
a vegetarian.
I was just going to say, I'm waiting for it.
Metaphor. Celery, Kevin. Celery.
No, I'm just saying I can't help.
Okay. So consumer products. One of the other things that happened this year, so drones have been a lot in the news this year, and the piece specifically that was flagged by Scientific American was that the FAA formally decreed that drone pilots, even hobbyists, are aviators and must accept all the rights and responsibilities that come with this designation. So the news specifically, not so important. What my point was largely about referencing this was that, you know, one of the other things about the changing sort of world that we live in that will have really big impacts on our ability to live our lives and the type of world that we live in is that, you know, it's generally been a historical fact until very recently that tools and the ability to create tools and to use things that will give power have generally been very easy to control. So, for instance, swords. It took, you know, a knight or a king or somebody with a vast amount of property to even be able to hire, you know, get people to do this for them. And to be able to do it on a large scale to become any sort of military force was quite the endeavor and required quite a bit of, you know, you couldn't just sort of let's fight back against the king, and you know everyone didn't have a sword lying around, right? So this the means of production of tools, whether they be weapons or implements or farm tools or whatever they might be, has been very easy to sort of control and cordon. And we now, with the example of the drones and things like 3D printers and laser cutters and all sorts of things. I mean, I watched a YouTube video a little while ago where a young man with the guidance of his father, but a young man who looks under the age of 15, I would say, if I had to guess, he was probably about 13, 14, if I had to guess, had successfully mounted a 9mm pistol on top of a 4-prop drone. And it was actually very impressive because they managed to the young man and his father had managed to design this in a way that it actually accounted for the kickback. So the gun was actually able to be remotely fired from a cell phone, and the drone continued to fly. So this was a completely functional drone-operated, homemade, armed drone. And so, I mean, we live in a world now where, yes, you know, the militarization of police is excessive, and many people's comments, depending on where you live, to varying degrees about the idea about living in a police state is, you know, can be to varying degrees of true, depending on where in the world you live. But it can't be denied that the ability to keep a control on technology that could threaten power, whoever's power that might be, is now incredibly hard to control. And this has raised the stakes a little bit because the people that want to maintain control are aware of the fact that they are losing their grip on control in subtle ways. And it's really changing the landscape. I mean, I can't tell you how many times this year I've heard someone casually reference, you know, armed resistance against the government. And every single one of those cases has been a joke. But the fact is, it's coming up. The idea of conflict with power seems to be a social meme, and it's coming into this way because the playing field to a large degree has been leveled, as whether you're talking about actual violence or whether you're just talking about being able to, you know, anonymous being able to break into just about anybody's computer, or the ability of a 9-year-old or 10-year-old or 15-year-old and his dad to create a drone with a gun on it. So I will pause there again to leave into the floor this sort of idea of the leveled playing field of technology and the incredible way in which it's changing the way the world works.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting example because it brings up so many different dimensions, right? One, looking at what people might call like the decentralization of certain types of power, in this case, sort of something that looks a little bit menacing. But also, I think the issue around disassociation, right? If we are developing technologies, and I think the drone is a good example, that allow us to be one removed from our action, that concerns me in terms of how we relate to other human beings and the natural world. So, I mean, we've seen drones being deployed in the militaristic sense with a lot of condemnation from a human rights point of view in terms of what's happening in the Middle East. But we're also seeing the accessibility of drones to a generation that has also grown up playing video games, which is another form of disassociation, you could argue. I don't know how far down that rabbit hole we want to go, but I think that scares me when you remove that direct interaction. I think technology can have the opposite effect. I think it can be connecting from a humanistic point of view with the people and planet, but this scares me quite a bit. And I don't know what you think about that, Kevin, in terms of what does it mean? We're talking about trying to be more connected with our natural world, but yet what do technologies like drones have, like how do they impact that kind of sensibility?
Ooh.
Do you want to go there?
I was going to say, let's go to our resident old man to talk about technology.
Yeah, to talk about, what's this, what are all these lights and buttons in here doing? I'm just so confused, everything's blinking at me. Yeah, well, obviously the pace and change of technology has been, I was in high school when the first pocket calculator came out, so I've seen this happen. And I grew up reading science fiction, so I wondered about the brave new world we were headed for. And I got to see a lot of it happen, really. I mean, I remember watching the first moon landing on television. And with regards to the drones, it's interesting. Yeah, that's by definition going to be a disruptive technology on every front. And I remember the ancient Greeks used to think archery was dishonorable combat. Because if you were going to run a man through, you had to be holding the sword and looking him in the eye, basically, when you did it. Of course, the phenomenal tactical advantage of archery just changed that conversation very quickly. You on honor, there's just no room for honor when people can wipe you out casually with very minimal effort from a great distance. And that kind of sums up drone technology nicely. And I agree, it's it is very dissociative. And I think in general, and if you read the accounts of some of the people who fly these drones, they do find it a very sort of dissociating experience, and they have a great deal of trouble with this. And on the same note, Elon Musk was recently awarded, I forget by whom now, but somebody awarded him the Luddite of the Year award for his this is Elon Musk, mind you, right, the guy that is, you know, patented batteries for electric cars, and he just his company just landed a rocket on its tail for the first time in history, which is no mean engineering feat. And he was awarded Luddite of the Year for his fears of artificial intelligence. And I just could not agree more. And I don't want to go into that, but for people who like to throw the anti-technology slur out there, Luddite, you know, if you're just like, all technology is good, it's all progress, don't you know? All new technology is progress, and progress is always going forward. And going back to anything, even if it's a better way, that's going backwards. That's a lack of progress. And these are some really ridiculous and uncritical tropes that have gotten into our dominant discourse. But the Luddites, as far as I know, were not at all opposed to technology. They were destroying automatic looms that were putting them out of business. These were weavers destroying machines that were making them destitute, unemployable and destitute. Yeah. I mean, how do you argue against that? It's not even a fear of technology, and that's still a legitimate fear of technology. And we were talking about this before the show. Mm. People are being increasingly put out of work by automation, and yet we're not sharing in the gains that we're making in productivity and efficiency and wealth that are being derived through technology. The people who own the technology own that work product, and people are being put out of work. To, you know, so in that sense, you know, call me a Luddite absolutely any day of the week, and I'm by no means against technology. I'm just much more for a sane society that includes you know, human values.
Well, and one of the, and just a brief comment, then actually I'm going to go back to Emma on that, but kind of the idea too, like, you know, people will say how dangerous it might be, and it's an oft sort of theme in science fiction to do stories. I've been rewatching, because it's slowed down over the holidays, a bunch of old Star Trek Next Generation episodes, and it's a very common theme in science fiction to have this idea of, well, you know, you know, if somebody brought technology back from the future, that could be very dangerous because, you know, it's so powerful and society hasn't adapted to integrate it properly that, you know, it's that the person using it couldn't possibly understand the implications of the technology they're using or what effect it might have because they haven't sort of grown up with it. They don't fully understand, blah, 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 you know, this. So it's very dangerous to give people technology that's beyond their ability to comprehend the impacts of using it. But what we're looking at here as well on this Earth is that we're looking at a world where there is such disparity between the prime of the first world nations and the disparity of despair in some of the most impoverished that you might as well have a 200-year gap. You know, if we were all part of one society, there would be somewhere near 150 and 200-year gap between these societies if we didn't have sort of an imbalanced system and just as far as not as far as intelligence or thought, but as far as the types of tools that they have available. So when you take somebody who, for instance, you know, let's touch briefly on international terror, which was another sort of theme of this year, was you know, ISIL and whatever, blah blah blah. Is that, you know, if you're taking someone who's, you know, very angry for a bunch of reasons and maybe they're crazy, I'm not going to try and, you know, put my thoughts into why those people do those things. But if you take somebody who's not terribly well educated, which the majority of them aren't, and give them something like, say, maybe nuclear technology, they're not going to understand what they're going to do when they maybe think, oh, this is a great idea. Let's try and smuggle a suitcase bomb to the U.S., right? So they might be, haha, we'll stick it to the Americans. But the global catastrophe that could set off, like a bunch of dead man switches in Russia, or like whatever, like it's someone using technology that they have no comprehension of the sort of bigger picture here. And this sort of, to me, I would submit, is yet another example of the fact that we can't have this big a gap in our planet when we all live on the same Earth. And I make that as a very roundabout case for yet again coming back to the thing that we need to start thinking as a planet and maybe lowering down the first world's advances a little bit to catch the rest of the world up, because that disparity is one of the greatest causes of one of social unrest and violence that exists, and we could solve it really easily if half of the world wasn't desperately poor, a quarter of the world was somewhat, you know, poor, and a very small portion of people have almost all of the resources.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what keeps me up at night in terms of the consequences of exposing people that perhaps haven't had access to technology, some dangerous, and not knowing how to handle it. I think I'd say that's true across the board, actually. I think as a global society or societies, we all are not able to project forward enough to understand the full consequences of all these technologies that have been deployed. That scares me universally.
Oh, and sorry, I just want to clarify. Yeah. And I didn't just mean, you know, nukes getting into the hands of ISIL. I also mean we don't yet understand the implications of using drones even.
Like, sure, yeah, totally. So we're in agreement there. But I think also we're seeing on the flip side of that, I think the example that's always sort of held up is the fact that a very significant portion of the world kind of skipped the landline generation and went straight to cell phones. And so you have these really nice examples, just to inject a little positivity, of, you know, cell phones being charged from solar panels in a remote village, you know, somewhere. And so I think, you know, we can derive a lot of benefits from technology, but I do agree that there's both opportunity to have technology be an equalizing factor, but I agree with you, Darren, that that's not the general trend. So we need to do something to rebalance things, as you're saying, in terms of looking at how technology can be more equalizing and how it's not just, as Kevin's saying, full steam ahead, all things tech are good. And if you have anything around, you know, managing the risk, that you are seen as a regressive factor in our society. We need to change that kind of outlook.
Mm-hmm. So my prescription for that one before moving on would simply be that, yeah, I'm not saying that we should slow down technological advance necessarily. What I'm saying is that is essentially that technology is what is researched and what is developed is directed currently by capitalist markets, and those capitalist markets are designing and developing technology for the convenience and entertainment needs of a very small portion of the planet, and that Not that we should stop doing that research, but that let's decide that, hey, we've got some global problems. How about we direct resources into solving those problems before we figure out how to make an iPhone 7? Like, those priorities, iPhone 6 will do for 3 years, I swear. how about we spend 5 minutes, you know, feeding people or something? Like, you know what I mean? Like, we just, the imbalance is getting so ridiculous that it's now almost trivial if we didn't have to worry about who was going to pay for it. And oh, I know somebody is there freaking out. Oh, that's the entire point. We're going to get to that, how to pay for it, in a second. But if we, you know, if you forget the how to pay for it for a second, we could solve a lot of these problems very, very quickly.
I've always thought we need an Office of Emerging Technology in government, and it needs to be staffed by, you know, really, really highly caffeinated science fiction fans staying up all night.
You mean like us right now?
Yeah, like pretty much all of us. It's true. I am quite highly caffeinated at the moment too. But I mean, if you read about. I mean, if you want to have a sleepless night, I can give you some things to Google.
He's not lying, folks.
No, I'm not. CRISPR, which is CRISPR, CRISPR. It's a new. It is a quantum leap forward in our ability to edit genes, and people are talking about all kinds of stuff now, like pushing changes, genetic changes, through entire wild populations of things like mosquitoes, because let's admit it, they're a disease vector. They bring things like malaria. Malaria is a scourge, without a doubt, in countries that suffer from it. But they also carry, if I'm not mistaken, dengue fever and, oh God, I can never pronounce this, I'm not even going to try it. If anyone can pronounce that, please let me know. And you know, that's where the ethical rubber meets the road, is when you're in any country that is suffering the scourge of malaria, and you're saying, well, hey, why not? Let's drive some genetic change to the population of mosquitoes, and rid ourselves of this. But it's always the law of unintended consequences. And you know, Google DARPA. Go to DARPA's website and see the kinds of things they're experimenting with. And there was another one. So CRISPR, DARPA. No, it got away from me now, people are trying to there's active research into how to build artificial wombs. Think about that for a minute. You know, there's I mean, all of these things can have unintended consequences, and it just goes like ever since the Cold War, we've been arguing with ourselves or debating, you know, is wisdom evolving as quickly as technology? And of course it isn't.
Yeah, it's conclusively no.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't see a problem. I actually see a real need for there to be a government office staffed with, without a doubt, caffeinated sci-fi freaks and also ethicists, bioethicists, yeah. All manner of people that are sort of thinking about these things, because we simply do not need to rush every new thing into the marketplace the moment every new chemical. It's a no stick pan. It must be better. Many years later, you discover your body's full of Teflon. You know, all these things just simply do not need to be rushed into the marketplace. Every new technology is not some shiny new thing that makes life better. These things need to be considered, and we just need to bring more deliberation to this.
Yeah, because of the non-traditional format of the show, I have completely left reckless abandon as to what time it is. So we're a bit overdue for a music break. Just before we go to our music break, though, I'll say, if you want to apply for that office, you just need to send in 200 words or less why Star Wars or Star Trek is better, and your most recent three pieces of fan fiction to apply for that office. You're listening to, it might surprise you today, if you might, other than maybe recognizing the voices, but this is in fact the Green Majority. You are listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to be back with our lackadaisical sort of rambling discussion about the world that is 2015 here on this week's Christmas Day show. So Kevin Farmer, please spin us some beats, and we will be right back.
In my way did I use you? Do you think I really abused you? On reflection now, it doesn't matter. How could you see in me what you want me to be? Now, on reflection.
visualization. Change my poetry all around, 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 all around.
And I sympathize with you, but I never lie to you. All in all, it seems it's just an experience.
Place my cards on the table, so that when the thing was able, understanding still, not understanding difference, coming
Ooh, I think that's a good spot to come back in. Thank you very much, Kevin. So you're listening here to The Green Majority here on CIUT on our very abnormal holiday show. Today is Christmas Day as we're broadcasting live from Hart House because none of the three of us have anywhere we needed to be, apparently. and so as we do, if you're just tuning in here, again, that we are The Green Majority. And what we're doing this week is just sort of taking a very relaxed attitude to the whole thing and kind of looking back a little bit. And then I will be replaced by Stefan next week, and MA and Kevin will also be here. And they'll be doing a bit more of a specific sort of look forward. So this is sort of a contemplative look back. Next week will be a bit of a contemplative look forward. But what we're doing at the moment kind of is going is I'm making a bit of a case, I guess, here using some top 10 lists. I actually haven't veered very far from the Scientific American one just yet because there's so much goodness in here about things that happened this year and sort of what might be assessed from it, what might be pondered by it. Kevin, I just wanted to let you know I wasn't going to get back into it here, but on this very list, I hadn't scrolled down far enough, but number two on this list is actually the CRISPR revolution gains momentum. So you picked it well on that one. What I wanted to come to really quickly, though, of course, was so, of course, you know, we talk all the time about climate change. So climate change is another sort of example of a global problem to which that demands a global solution. We attempted to and may or may not have gotten one. We'll talk a bit more about what happened at COP, rather what's going to be happening from what the agreement that happened in COP later in January, once we actually see what begins to happen as people's gears start to grind on that. But while we're doing this piece, the last thing I wanted to come to before I got to my yes, okay, but how do you implement all these crazy ideas part, which will come up in just a moment, I wanted to mention the very last one, which was, I sort of touched on it a minute with the technology, but I think it's specific enough that it deserves direct and specific separate attention, which is data security. The idea, and this is something about which Kevin, I'm sure, will have a comment as well. This is a topic of which he's at least somewhat familiar and has a bit of expertise in, at least generally speaking. And the idea here essentially is that they're basically everything. I'm not telling anybody anything they don't know, but just for the sake of setting out my case, almost everything now is computerized, right? Chips in your car, there are chips in people's shoes. RFID tags are automatically telling machines how to do things. Almost everything in our life has computers in it, and if it doesn't yet, it will soon, including your pants and shirts, all sorts of things. I'm not pulling these out of my hat, as it were. These are all things that are about to be computerized or in some way have computer chips put in them. And this has meant that when we're talking about security, it's increasingly getting distorted about, well, what do we mean by that? Physical security is less and less important, and rising is the age of cybersecurity. And one of the things that we've noticed from this is that agencies like Anonymous, for instance, amorphous hacker groups, and just random vigilantes and whoever else, basically any 14-year-old that grew up with a laptop, can now exact some pretty severe damage with at least a partial hope of being able to stay anonymous while doing it and not getting caught. It's created an entirely new way in which we need to think about our safety, whether we're talking about our physical safety because somebody theoretically could hack into your car. Some claim that this has already happened. Anywhere all the way down to somebody stealing your personal identifying information. And again, this is something that is a problem because it's essentially a distortion of power, and it's a way for people to sort of take some of that power back. And so it's become the internet, and specifically breaking security, has become some of the sort of favorite mischievous pastime of a lot of people, because it's a very easy way to cause a lot of damage from the safety and security of your own home. And it really is changing the world in which we live in, especially when we tie this back to things like automated weapon systems, which could be hacked. So I'll tie this up with a nice little bow afterwards, but I'll go now to MA first for comment about that.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect example of something that's accelerating and is complex. Especially, it's really interesting because a lot of us might initially perceive actions by groups like Anonymous as a kind of rebalancing. Mm-hmm. So you may not be fully comfortable with it. You may not 100% agree with everything they do or their position, but you see them trying to address perhaps miscarriages of justice or things like that, or rebalance control away from the state or that kind of thing. But it's a complex ethical challenge, let me put it that way, because if you were deemed by any sort of hacker group to have done some sort of wrongdoing, and there was no sort of due process before something from your personal data was obtained and made public, you probably wouldn't feel that positive about that action. So I think it is a very complex thing for us to consider. Personally, I think we need to see a lot more movement in terms of people, citizens, owning their own data, not corporation, not government, being the first line in terms of deciding what is done with their data. And the same goes for communities. And there's some interesting sort of movements around data issues as they apply to technology. And technology certainly is confronting us with these data issues, but they've been going on for some time. And there's an indigenous term called OCAP, which is Ownership, Control, Access, and Possession. And it was raised, I believe, first and foremost by actually a nurse in New Zealand. And it's certainly been incorporated into frameworks here in Canada, which is Indigenous people do not want to be studied and have their data taken away. They want to own their own data. They want to decide what's done with it. And I just think it's a really important example of positive trends around data ownership, and something that I think that non-Indigenous populations should learn about and be educated, because we as people in this ever-changing world need to start being a lot more aware and seeking to have better ownership over our own data.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, I'll go to you for a comment before I tie this up with a bow.
Oh, just could not agree more with that. People, I think your data is yours by definition, your personal, and the people who are all excited about this Internet of Things that Darren alluded to, it's being referred, what you alluded to is being referred to as the Internet of Things, and we're talking about billions upon billions of devices, your fridge connected, to the internet essentially. And the people who are really excited about these technologies tend to be the data miners, the companies like Google that just want to know everything about you. And it might be very exciting to have your fridge let you know when your mushrooms are getting old and telling you what should be on your next shopping list. And actually, hey, let's just print that for you, or even just alert the store to see that they order what you need. And these things, these sort of like, I don't know, kind of like these technological utopias that we think we're headed for, they're just too easily exploitable. And the one that comes back time and time again is, should we make voting online? Should we do that online? Mm. I can't imagine anything worse than that. It just goes without saying that nothing online will ever be perfectly secure. It just won't be. And we didn't need online voting to hijack a recent election here in Canada. We just needed phones, right, with the robocalls. To put something like that online just strikes me as orders of magnitude less secure. You could possibly hijack an election and not even leave a trace, or at least disrupt it so thoroughly, or taint it with an air of illegitimacy. And the thought of people, I mean, one, again, it disconnects people even more, because there is something to be said for the act of going out and voting. It is a form of community participation, such as it is. And the thought of people being at home, perhaps having their vote dictated to them by some coercive guardian, read man, it also strikes me as just an incredibly bad idea. And again, it's just one of these things where everyone's like, oh, no, it's better. Everything's better. It's the magpie reflex. It's, mm-hmm. If it's shiny and new, it just must be better. And all technology just must be better. And I think with the Internet of Things, and especially – well, actually, no, I'm not even going to qualify that. With online voting and the Internet of Things, again, the precautionary principle needs to rule the day.
All right, so we're running down to about, oh man, we've only got about 15 minutes left. So here's what I'd like to do. I'm gonna mention one thing really quickly. Let's take a very short music break, and then we'll come back and have sort of closing comments on that. How's that work, Kevin?
Sure. So if anyone's curious about the first song, as the resident old man, when Darren said the show would be about reflection, I remembered I have my iPod. It's a piece of technology. And that was
hypocrite.
No, that was a band called the Gentle Giant, and that was their song On Reflection. I'm pretty sure that was written back in the 70s, which was a thing.
The
70s were a thing, even though I'm sure they weren't referred to once by the Simpsons. And actually this song I'm covering a lot of time here at the studio over the holidays, because it's an army of volunteers, folks, and we take vacations every so often. So I'm covering a lot of time. And next week, New Year's Day, from 4 till 5, I'm doing an interview with a very talented musician who's a very old friend of mine called Lily Mason, and this is one of her songs.
To be a star, but she isn't getting far. Sometimes it's just too hard.
Oh, take your time.
She's tried and she's tried all the tears she's cried. She's turning 17,
and her dream,
and her dream,
and her dream,
and her dream,
her dream is still a dream.
Family wants to see. Take your time. What's right will feel right. You don't have to fight. Although you'll be 18, you'll have time.
You'll have time.
You'll have time.
You'll have time
to choose your
We are back. We cut that one a little bit short here because we're running tight on time, because I apparently do not know how to talk less. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT on our very relaxed holiday show. I'm going to mention one very, very quickly last thing, and then we'll go into our final closing comments about my conclusion, where I was going with this whole thing. So the very last thing was, Kevin mentioned briefly earlier there, we have SpaceX relanding rockets for reusable things and all sorts of space exploration. We found potential water, or I forget if we actually did for sure find water, or if there's just a very strong indicator of water on Mars, all sorts of water and potentially planets hovering around the habitable zone in other places. Whether or not this means that we will find life, it does open a much more assuredly another option, which is the possibility and impending inevitability, in my opinion, of the possibility of not just leaving, but colonizing places other than this Earth, or at the very least for now, creating temporary habitats in places other than this planet. And the reason I wanted to mention that one last to sort of tie this together, what I wanted to tie it together with was the idea that whether we're talking about disparity when it comes to the application access or use or development of technology, whether we're talking about any of those words I just mentioned with relation to food or to just general wealth. The idea that, you know, because we now live on a globalized planet, the idea that, you know, one country should be really, have really poor healthcare and be really overcrowded and have a lot of sick people that then, you know, creates a breeding ground for disease that then spreads some horrible new disease or some we thought we took care of it old disease, you know, all the way around the planet and creates a serious global, you know, danger impacting not just that area, but lots of people's lives. You know, not to mention the theme of this show half the time, climate change, which is a series of global problems that are urging for global solutions. They require solutions that are global because they are global solutions that affect all of us. It's not just, does it sound nice to say that and it seem equitable, but I would submit that it is required. We will not solve these problems unless we make a global effort of them. And so this begs the question now, well, how are you going to pay for all this fantastic stuff? How are you going to pay to bring the poorer parts of the world up to the standard of the first world? How are you going to pay to give away all this technology? How are you going to pay to get rid of all of this poverty? And, well, part of the answer is that a lot of these problems are artificially created by people's greed and gamed systems that keep these people in place, and that a lot of these people aren't just down, they're being held down by richer nations, by governments such as ours, I'm sorry to tell you, in many direct and indirect ways. But that this is a problem that's not because of necessarily evil people being in charge. It's a problem that's systemic, and it's systemic in the sense that things don't happen on Earth right now and have not for quite some time unless someone can profit off of them. And it does not matter if we're talking about war. It does not matter if we're talking about saving people's lives with drugs. It does not matter what we talk about nary at all, I would submit. If somebody can't profit, it won't happen, apparently, unless we're talking about extremely minute personal exchanges like, you know, me buying you an apple. And for me, I would submit that the profit there is the your joy in receiving the apple would benefit me. So my case stands if you admit that. So what I wanted to bring this to is we have a whole bunch of global problems, I submit, that we cannot solve without looking at them globally, and that profit and the need to profit, the things not being able to happen without profit, is the number one thing stopping us from do this. So I submit that I've now made my case, and I will go to comment for MA and then to Kevin. Is it time? Can we, should we, and nay, do we have to have a conversation globally? Let's sit down and have a little wee chat about whether or not the idea that things can only happen if someone can profit off them is the ruling governing law of our planet.
So what I fundamentally believe is that we shouldn't do anything or suggest a course of action that removes people's incentives to contribute in an entrepreneurial way to their well-being and happiness. So one of these sort of counter arguments to your position, Darren, is, you know, that you're taking away people's personal motivations to innovate and do things that are going to increase their well-being. And I think that is a misconception. And what we need to change is actually how we think about what makes us happy and what well-being is. It's not that we can't be entrepreneurial and make stuff and sell stuff, but the terms and the motivation for doing so does need to shift from a global perspective. So here we are talking about this on what is for many people a family holiday, but also one of the most commercial holidays of the year, where we go out and we buy a whole load of stuff for everybody that we know. Some of us do that, not all of us. But we need to change our conception of what we think others need and what we think we need. And then if we do that, we will also change some of our behavioral patterns. I'm not a person that likes to talk about individual behavioral change. I'm much more focused on what governments ought to be doing to address big picture issues like climate change and how we as engaged citizens need to be pressuring them and also, you know, building grassroots movements, et cetera, et cetera. But I really think that sometimes it is important to think about individual action and think about what we're willing to let go of that actually won't change our level of happiness. We may think it will initially, but it won't. And then the other thing I also want to bring in is like more holistic concepts of well-being. So if you start looking at what makes us happy and what we want to derive out of life, yes, there's some very essential things that a lot of the population is deprived of, and we need to address that. We also need to look at the other things that contribute to people's happiness, which is a sense of community and a connection with the natural world. And one, I'm just going to conclude by making one point about these expeditions to Mars and colonizing other planets. Like, I don't want to crush anyone's sense of exploration, the spirit of exploration, which is part of being human, I think. But I just find it so completely ironic that if you go and say, let's go stand in the field outside of where we are, the Hart House, it's such a marvel. All these things that we are pouring millions, perhaps billions of dollars in terms of looking at how we could potentially recreate that square of field on another planet, terraform it. And we have it. We have it right here. The miracle of our own planet, every corner of our planet, and that yet we would strive to just do a little piece of that somewhere else is, I think, quite ironic. So I'll end there.
I call that the because I can attitude, which is actually just a rephrase of what Kevin was saying earlier. But Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, once again, could not agree more. And you reminded me of my other Googleable sleepless night. Google the Fermi paradox. And
ooh, nice one.
It is a good one, because if it turns out that life is essentially inevitable on planets such as Earth that just have the right conditions, then the question is, well, why don't we see any of it? And it's a good brain teaser. It's like, why, you know, if life is inevitable, why don't we see intelligent life in the universe? And the other thing that you touched on that I think we really ought to follow up with on this show at some point in time is this notion of endless profit. I don't know in what closed system the participants can endlessly profit from each other in any way that makes sense according to the laws of thermodynamics. We there's tremendous wealth disparity in this country and on this planet. But the simple fact of the matter is, if we could get over that, we can provide for all of our primary needs. We can provide for all of our secondary needs. We just don't need to keep tearing this planet apart for new cell phones.
I'm sorry to have to do this on air, Kevin, but I'm looking at two very disparate times here between my two different timepieces. Can you let me know how much time we've got left, please?
Well, that's been a recurring problem lately. I give us about 3 minutes to master.
3 minutes, okay, because I had 3 minutes and 8 minutes, and I just wanted to check. Thank you.
Oh, I thought you were going to be very sort of metaphysical and say, how much time do we have left, Kevin?
Yes, Kevin Farmer, how much time do we have left?
Planet before we have to move to Mars?
I bit my tongue on that, to be honest with you. I just totally bit my tongue.
The last thing that I wanted to sort of get at with that, and I think I explained it accurately what I meant, but I think I can do a bit better as far as what I was getting at there. And thank you. I think MA and Kevin both picked up on it, what I did and didn't mean by that correctly, which is the idea that, yes, the reason capitalism works for an extent is an incentive system. And I think it's an incentive system that rewards, as you say, very, very accurately, it rewards effort and innovation and entrepreneurialism. And those are how many of our problems are solved. And so those are good things. We want those things. And so taking that type of system away is, of course, not what I was suggesting. And I know that you weren't implying that I was. But just for clarity of sort of the listener, what I'm saying here was that those things are good things, but why don't we find a way to substitute money? Now, the reason I'm saying that is very specific, is because, you know, if you think back to the beginning of this episode, what we're talking about is that, you know, essentially technology in a variety of ways is making our traditional system obsolete. It's meaning that, you know, almost all jobs, Kevin mentioned before we even got started the idea that most sports writing or some sports writing anyway is done by AI programs. Robotics and cybernetics are replacing all types of jobs. I mean, jobs are flooding out of the market because of technology way faster than we're creating them, even if the population wasn't growing. So this is a problem which is bad and is going to continue to get worse. And it's only a problem if we have to find a way to employ these people. I submit that we have now reached a level of technology where we don't need to do that. We can, if we took away the idea that someone has to make a buck here, we can provide for all the basic needs of all of the people on this planet. Now, you would say, okay, but, well, why would we do that? Because then you take away the profit incentive. Well, you don't need to profit. those people don't need jobs if their needs are taken for, right? So what we're talking about here, and I'm not submitting that I have the plan about how to do this. I'm submitting that we should at least admit that we're allowed to have this conversation, and that it is a rational conversation to have, that maybe there's another way that we can go about doing this, because the idea of exchange for labor to meet needs is no longer relevant on a world where we can meet all of our needs. So let's have a think. This Christmas break, what would you do to make the world a better place if we didn't have to worry about money? That's my final thought for this week. Good. Have a good green week, folks. We'll be back. Same team, but instead of me, you'll be Stefan next week for New Year's Day show. And then after that, we're going to have some new co-hosts. That's really exciting. I'm looking forward to it. Have a good green week, folks, and we'll see y'all real soon.